I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Every time I had gotten distracted, I thought, I can't do this. I can't meditate. It's not for me. And I gave up. But now I realize that, hey, this is like practicing music. It's practice. You know, you play a piece of music, you're going to make a mistake. You don't beat yourself up. You just repeat the passage until you get it right. Mm. And when I made that connection between practicing music and practicing meditation, it all worked. And as you say, it opened up a whole new world, yeah.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu. I'm back with Mind Rolling. And my guest today is Richard Wolff. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for inviting me on. I really appreciate it. It's an honor.
Richard is right down the pike. Actually, I've been doing, Richard, some podcasts lately around, with the various musicians and so on, because we have a music series of Soulland Music. Ram Dass's Soulland Music. So, Richard, you really, this book is, it's, as I said before, it's right down the pike. It's called In Tune, and it's really around music and mindfulness. And it's very instructive and well worth everybody's attention. So thank you for writing that, Richard.
Thank you for reading it.
But a little bit about yourself. I mean, I have some idea, but what are the things that even got you to the point where something like mindfulness made sense in any way?
I was forced into it pretty much because it was the only alternative that I was given to get out of a very bad state of mind where I was suffering from acute anxiety and panic.
And as a teenager, are you talking?
No, I was already an adult with a family and working in TV music. I had been in the record business, but I moved to TV thinking that would be less stressful. And boy, was I breathtakingly wide of the mark there. And so I had a severe panic attack, and my therapist prescribed meditation. And I had been trying to do meditation pretty much since you mentioned I was a teenager. So I was 17. I went to the Zen Center, and I learned how to sit Zazen. And I think because I'm a musician, I was able to sit there. But my mind was completely bonkers. I mean, I couldn't concentrate, but I would show up and sit. I couldn't do it, and tried in college. I couldn't do it, but now I had to do it. If that's my prescription to get out of this panic hell, I needed to meditate. And so I researched and found a way to do it.
Hmm. But that obviously led to beyond just meditation. There's perhaps another world that's not my senses, thinking mind, etc. When did that happen?
Well, it happens when you meditate seriously for a considerable amount of time. And what happened was I realized, I read a book called Training Your Mind to Be an Ally by a Tibetan animal trainer who was also a meditation master. And he compared the mind to a wild animal, like a horse. He was a horse trainer. And he said, when the horse gets distracted and goes off the road, you gently lead it back to the road. Now, every time I had gotten distracted, I thought, I can't do this. I can't meditate. It's not for me. And I gave up. But now I realize that, hey, this is like practicing music. It's practice. You know, you play a piece of music, you're going to make a mistake. You don't beat yourself up. You just repeat the passage until you get it right. Mm. And when I made that connection between practicing music and practicing meditation, it all worked. And as you say, it opened up a whole new world. Yeah, there were the first connection I saw was practice, practice for the sake of practice, having faith and trust and believe that no matter how much drudgery it is to just go over the scales, go over the same song, you're going to be able to play it and master it if you just practice. And when I made that connection, then all these other connections, I call them bridges, became apparent between the practice of music and the practice of meditation.
Yeah. Well, that's really definitive through this book, that through line. And you say, underscoring these connections, the classic meditation teachings of Zazen, Pranayama, and Vipassana, which is something that I was introduced to when I first went to India and has become a through line for me all this time, can be approached from an instinctively musical perspective, which you just actually connected. That's very much connected with what you just said, but maybe further that a little bit. How are these approaches, how can they be approached from an instinctively musical perspective?
Well, it's about listening and about hearing music. It's about exploring your interior soundscape. So I emphasize the listening part in terms of meditating. And we, you know, most of so many meditation traditions rely on listening, or actually counting the breath, paying attention, following. They call that following the breath, right? So how do you follow the breath? It's very hard to do for hours at a time, or minutes at a time for that matter. And one way is to hear tones. As you inhale, you hear a tone. As you exhale, another tone. It becomes an interesting event without getting complicated, without getting wrapped up in specifics or technicalities. Just whatever you hear, you notice when you're breathing. Whatever tone you hear, you notice that. And same thing with counting. Musicians are inherently able to count beats, right? Mm. I mean, there's a famous story of Albert Einstein was a violin player, and he would play with like the best pianists, but he had no rhythm. And so one time Vladimir Horace says to him, Albert, don't you have any sense of time? So we count subconsciously, you know, and the way we count is 1, 2, 3, 4, mm. 2, 2, 3, 4. So I'm getting very into the woods, into the weeds here, I guess, woods, weeds. But to answer your question, that's one way that, you know, your inherent abilities as musicians can be applied to meditation techniques. Hmm.
Forget about all of the mindfulness and, you know, and music and all of it. There's one thing you've got to relate. When I saw it in the book, I went, wow, what? You had lunch with Miles Davis. I don't give a shit about anything else that's in this book, okay? I'm kidding. But can you tell that story? That's wild, man.
Yeah. I was friends. This is the mid-80s. I think it's 1985. And I was friends with Tommy La Puma. Mm-hmm. And Tommy La Puma was producing Miles Davis. He produced records in the 80s on Miles Davis. And I was in Tommy's house. The phone rings. Apparently, it's Miles. He says, yeah, okay, we'll be there in 10 minutes. And he says to me, you want to come with me to lunch with Miles? I'm going, yes.
Wow.
You know, what kind of question is, of course. So we go to this restaurant on Fifth Avenue. Tommy was living on Fifth Avenue, so it was a couple of blocks away. But it's springtime. It's kind of hot. And we go in this restaurant, I don't know, 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. There's nobody there. Except at the end of a table, there's a very regal-looking gentleman wearing this beautiful, huge, heavy fur coat. And that was Miles. And so it was just the three of us. It was Tommy, me, and Miles. And Miles was loquacious. He was in a good mood, and he was talking and, you know, telling stories. And some of the stories I would love to tell, some of them may not be appropriate, proper. But then he just stopped in the middle of the stories and he turns to me and he says, you know what the most important lesson I learned about music? I said, no, what's that, Miles? And he said, the importance of silence.
Wow.
And when he said that, it resonated with me. I didn't understand fully what he was talking about. I knew I needed to understand that better, but that really made a deep impression on me I'll never forget.
Mm. Wow. That's a lot of detail.
He said he learned that from Ayerto, who was a Brazilian percussionist and was in his band for a while.
Who's still alive? I didn't know that.
I don't know. I don't know.
Uh-huh. Wow. Did you have dinner with John Coltrane, perhaps?
No, I never saw him live, but I know you're a John Coltrane fan.
Because I had the experience, which you discuss throughout this book, or certainly as a core result of what music can do and how it's really... It's the same. It is meditation. And once you do get a little bit concentrated, sometimes that happens without doing anything. And that happened to me with Coltrane in a club when I was very young. And I was transformed out of my little self in that moment and into a level of absorption, which was profound. It's a profound thing in my entire life, that particular incident. It made its mark. So, yeah, Coltrane. And that idea, absolutely. But the nice thing about what you talk about, Richard, is the different ways in which you can actually take action using music to enhance meditation, mindfulness, just general spacious awareness rather than reactive attachment to thoughts. Especially around attention and concentration.
Yes.
Talk about that from your point of view. And I know you've had many years of experience using this practice.
Yes.
But it can be frowned upon, or it can actually be spiritual bypass where you're doing it, where you are doing it, right? Or you're doing it for a motivation. There's a to get better, even, whatever it may be. So it's a difficult, the Eightfold Path in Buddhism, right? Right concentration.
Mm-hmm.
Is there for a reason, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
Right, concentration is also one of the seven factors of enlightenment, concentration.
Yeah.
I don't know the order, but yeah, I mean, was it okay if we go back to Coltrane for a minute?
Let's just, again, let's not talk about anything else here. And by the way, and someone like Coltrane, in my mind, talk about enormous powers of one-pointedness, where he is completely one with, that's what him, Hendrix, completely one with the instrument, voice, yeah, instrument, whatever. There are a few people that you can count on, maybe a few arms, I don't know. But
well,
still,
not only yeah, that, he practiced with his breath, right? That's a big deal. I mean, he would practice 8 hours a day. He's working on his breath. And how you can, he created what's called, as you know, sheets of sound, right? So it's a lot of notes he was able to play. So he took one breath, and with one breath, he was able to play all these different notes. And that's such an example of non-duality. You know, with one breath divides up into all these different notes, but it's all one. It's all one. And that was a conscious thing that he did, you know, and he had a unique voice, right? You could tell Coltrane a mile away, right? There's no mistake. That's Coltrane. So he had that singularity, but at the same time, it was effective in terms of moving you as an example. He was trying to express something universal. What he thought of as divine consciousness or universal consciousness or supreme love. So he, again, non-dualistically, he was singular and he was universal at the same time. And that's something very beautiful and unique about, you know, there's a church dedicated to Coltrane in San Francisco, yeah, right?
Well, and his wife certainly carried on.
But you asked me about concentration in Buddhist tradition is samadhi, right? And you get into deep concentration, and you're absolutely right. Music is a great vehicle for enhancing concentration because you're focusing all your attention, all your energies. It's not just your mental attention. It's your emotional attention. It's your physical attention. It's a physical, it's all three. It's like this melody, harmony, and rhythm. Those are the three elements, right? So there's mind, feeling, and body. And it's, as a matter of fact, it's called embodied cognition when you know.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. That from Vijay Iyer, amazing.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And so that's what meditation is, that too. You're in a state of embodied cognition. You're a state of harmony where your mind, body, and feeling are all unified as one. And that's something that's very common with music. So if you've had that experience in music, it's natural to port that over in meditation.
Hmm. Have you been I think you have been a real jazz fan. Is that right?
Oh, I'm still, yes.
Yeah. So you might remember Jackie McLean?
Of course.
So we did a couple of records at Triloka, the company that we had, with Jackie. And for those of you who do not know Jackie McLean is, he was a direct disciple of Charlie Parker, Bird. And he used to sit around and tell us stories that some of them were harrowing because Bird would do anything to get a fix. You know, he was a heroin addict, including stealing Jackie's axe and taking it down to the pawn shop. But before he did that, he said, "Don't trust anyone, Jackie." And he ended up, I mean, he was really a character. I mean, well, not a character, obviously, had a lot of demons. But Jackie McLean, the reason I thought of him as I read through the book was you have a little thing called The Beauty of Dissonance.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And even with Coltrane, I couldn't get down with when he really went out there. And Jackie McLean plays just a slightly flat underneath the note is his thing. It's not far enough to make you go, what the fuck, this guy can't. but it's enough to actually turn your whole insides in a completely different direction. It's the only time, like Jackie used to turn me on when we recorded together and we used to go to his gigs and so on. So dissonance is an interesting thing because it's also about, you know, we don't want to be uncomfortable in any way, which is what that whole Wim Hof thing about getting in ice water, you know, it's experiencing something opposite to what your comfort zone is a wake-up call, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you would feel about dissonance?
I mean, I think that's a good way to put it. It's contrasting harmony with disharmony, and it's real. I mean, there's a lot of disharmony in reality in life, right? Especially if you look at the social situation, the political situation is.
That's a whole way understatement, as I say, for today, yeah. But yeah.
So acknowledging disharmony and even using it as a balance, a contrast to harmony is a beautiful thing. I mean, composers have used it. Mozart used dissonance. Wagner used dissonance. Many composers use dissonance. You know, one idea is that the ideal is to have the middle way between disharmony and harmony. Hmm. Now, that's an idea that I have a hard time relating to on a personal level because, of course, I'm much more attracted to harmony, which really, I believe, underlines all of existence, peace, harmony, and beauty. So yeah. It's a hard concept to really cuddle up to, but it has its uses.
Yeah. I think one has to be on the level of a Coltrane or someone like that to be able to express in a way that doesn't stray from the art just to make a statement, which I think I have heard that before with, you know, I was a huge jazz fan when I was a teenager. And I saw, you know, people like Sonny Rollins and Mingus. And Mingus was incredible. Charlie Mingus.
Yeah. Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
The kind of compositions and so on, yeah. And Monk. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I wonder what's happening today because I don't follow it.
I was just going to say, you would love some of the musicians out today. Mm. Kamasi Washington, Robert Glasper. Now, Robert Glasper is a jazz musician who plays R&B jazz. And it's beautiful stuff. It's fantastic stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
What's his name again?
Robert Glasper.
Okay. Everybody, whoever's doing the show notes for this, please let's link up to these guys that are just aforementioned by Richard. Okay.
Yeah. Absolutely. Robert Glasper, Kamasi Washington.
Because I want to check them out. So let's give everybody an opportunity to check them out, especially you who are any kind of aficionado of jazz.
I got one for you. Flying Lotus. Because he's the nephew of Alice Coltrane.
Oh, really? Flying Lotus is the name
Flying Lotus. People call him Flylo. He's got his own label. Great jazz influenced hip hop.
Wow.
Combines jazz with hip hop. Great stuff.
Okay. Please link it up.
Yeah.
So we will.
And I do it too.
Oh,
modestly.
This is an opportunity because I know you're making a record right now. What is that going to be? And can you share?
Well, yeah. I resisted the idea of making a record for several reasons. One reason is because all the techniques that I'm teaching in the book mainly are about listening to your own inner music, encouraging you to be able to hear your interior sound and silence. So how do you make a record like that? I mean, you know, that's difficult to do. It's a lot of work that didn't attract me. But I just thought that I had somebody interview me and she said, Is there any kind of meditation music that isn't the new age, typical ambient, anything else like that? And a few people had asked me that, and I'm thinking, why not create music that's based on R&B, jazz, hip hop, because that's the kind of music that I do, and make that meditative, make that the kind of music that can help people settle in to a concentrated, calm state of mind. And, you know, the other reason I was resisting is because music is a bridge to a place, but it's not that place. And I didn't want to confuse people to think that, oh, you're listening to music and that's the end of meditation. That's it. You've meditated. That's all there is. And that's not the case. Meditation is like, think of a keyboard with all these different notes, right? So music is one of the notes. But so is mindfulness, so is pure awareness. I mean, we can go just to relieve anxiety. There's so many things that meditation does. And so I was hesitant, but because of those reasons, I decided, well, I'm not going to worry about, I'll have the message that there'll be versions of the songs where there's silence at the end, and then the song comes back. So, I created this album called Ambient Soul and the Pleasures of Peace, which has music in it to get you in a mindfulness state, to pay attention, to focus in a calm way, to get you in a state where you can listen to the sounds in your room, the sounds within you, and the silence, and based on R&B, jazz, and hip hop.
Cool. When is that happening?
Well, the single, this is the first single, Dark of the Night, Bright of the Stars, comes out this Friday.
Oh.
And then we'll, you know, that's June the 3rd, I think.
Okay, another thing for the show notes, we'll link that up on Spotify. And yeah, give us all a chance. That's great. Great, Richard. So speaking of what you're doing now, can you, a little bit of history of, I mean, you've been in the music business for quite some time. How about some highlights of your experiences therein?
Yeah. You're right. I've been doing music my whole professional life. It's hard to, I would say probably a couple of the highlights was working with Bell Biv DeVoe, New Edition, members of New Edition, Bell Biv DeVoe, and the first record that crossed over R&B, hip hop, and pop, Poison. That was certainly
a
highlight.
Poison.
Yeah. Working on a Prince song with Prince, even though it was very remote. Our communications were always through an interpreter. but that was a highlight. It's a highlight working with Freddie Mercury, his last album, and working with his voice and being entrusted to create a production based on just his voice.
Wow.
You know, there's a song I did on a cartoon called Static Shock that I thought was really cool. Working on NCIS was a lot of fun. Cyber Goth. Writing music for a character who was a goth girl. So completely different than meditation, you know, everything totally the opposite. Supposed to be unnerving, very fast, very aggressive, and a lot of fun.
That's great.
So I think every project, you know, you find something. I think that in every project you find something and then you just move on. You know, I don't dwell. I'm not attached to any of the stuff. It's stuff I did, and what's tomorrow? I'm always hearing music in my mind, no matter what I'm doing. Oh, you just keep moving.
You had Krishnadas on, didn't you, on your podcast?
Yeah,
that's how we met.
Yes, that's how we met.
So what he exemplifies in the West, you know, Indian chant, basically. We were doing in India when we were kids, and of course he was already a musician. I mean, he was interested in music. He was even was going to sing for what was that famous rock band back in Long Island that he, I can't remember their name, but a major band. They wanted him to be the lead singer. So he was into it. And, but basically, long story short, what came back to here, to the West, basically, was our own practice, which was kirtan, which was chant, rhythmic. And of course, we were Westerners, and you know, Krishnadas is Jai Utal. I don't know if you know Jai, using, oh, you would like him. He's a real musician. Krishnadas is like a musician that is serving who he is. Mm-hmm. Rather than a musician who is a professional, quote unquote, musician. And so a lot of the melodies were from the from our background, in this case, Krishnadas, who's, it would all be Western chord change. It was stuff that was familiar, so people could jump into it very easily. Yes. Rhythmic, familiar chord changes, you know, great little hooky melodic things. And then suddenly the medicine's going down pretty easy. Mm. You're not even thinking. Mm. And that is what we have represented to this day. I do it. And, you know, I don't do it in any other way except having, you know, 20, 30 people over. We do some kirtan and hang, food and kirtan, which is what Neem Karoli Baba had us doing in India the whole time we were there. He just would make sure we got fed and we sang. That was it. That's love, serve, remember, which is the only instructions we ever got from it.
What is it? Love, serve?
Love, serve, remember, which is the name of the foundation that serves all of this that gets represented. Be Here Now Network, which we are on. This sounds like a commercial or something. And Ramdas.org and everything else. But more the point is that talking about music and mindfulness, boy, oh boy, that's everything that we use predominantly as a practice is definitely what kirtan is, nothing more than a meditation and a way to become more mindful because it serves the same purpose. So, yeah, we are so with you, Richard, on this, I can't tell you. But you know what I loved? This one thing, the art of deep listening, I think that has to be talked about. I think that is so important in so many different ways. And you quote, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite.
Infinite.
William Blake, huh? Yeah. Great quote from him. Okay, we can exchange. Like, what do you mean about deep listening?
Well, first of all, I got to say with that, you know, Krishnadas is a big crush of mine. And to me, he's beyond singing and, you know, beyond sound and silence. He's the real deal. And you sing when you do kirtan? You're singing?
Yeah.
Well, you know, neuroscientifically, singing stimulates the vagus nerve. I have no idea what that means. No, I'm kidding. I don't know everything the vagus nerve does. I know it does a lot of things. It goes all the way to your brain. But I know that when you stimulate
it's a
that
good thing somehow, we know.
Yeah. I know when you stimulate that by singing, that stimulates the parasympathetic nervous system, which I know something about. That's the system that balances the fight or flight. Mm. You know, the sympathetic nervous system, that's the system that gets you to relax. So scientifically, when you're singing, that's got such a tranquilizing effect that's scientifically proven. But you wanted to talk about deep listening.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, that's a sensibility or skill, whatever you want to call that, that we have as musicians, that we can port over to our practice of meditation. Just being able to listen with as much attention as possible without being distracted or shattered in terms of our attention. And that is a real gift in terms of being able to concentrate. and being able to find that calm, composed state of mind and being. And to me, every sound is an echo of the soundless. So sound is a gateway to silence, to the soundless, which is really a place that we want to be, beyond sound, beyond silence, to the source of sound and silence. And so sound and music, these are gateways to get there. And another thing about deep listening is, just practically speaking in life, you know, you're used to listening to music and being discerning. If you're listening to Mingus or Coltrane, you're discerning what he's doing harmonically. You're discerning what the drummer's doing. You know, you're totally into the music, but you're listening carefully, deeply to the music. But when you're in life and somebody's talking to you, you're only listening with half an ear a lot of times. But if you realize you can mindfully listen to people and give them your full attention, that's what they really would value. That's what they value. They want to be heard. They want to be listened to. And you can also hear what they're not saying. You know, it's like Miles said, listen to the notes that aren't there. It's, you know, you can hear what people are not saying.
The writer, Simon Weil, I believe, this quote comes from her, and it's the most important and gracious offering that you can make to another human being is to give them full attention. The most generous offering you can make. And is it not that so? It's so, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, in all of our interactions, you know, and I know, and I'm a little bit of an ADD person, multitask. I'm really, you know, if I didn't meditate, I don't know, probably have burnt into a little burnt puppy already. Yeah, absolutely. I see clearly, because fortunately, after all these years, I can see the arising self-motivation easily as it comes up. And I see how I'm distracting from just being completely present, which is, by the way, you know, when I've told this a billion times, Richard, but it deserves it again, because we're talking about being here now. Mm-hmm. Right? And Mr. B here now, when I first met him, he completely let go of his identities and was totally present in the moment, and something I had not experienced before, that kind of complete attention. So he did that throughout his life, even when he was going through stuff and whatever, not the least of which was a stroke. He was able to do that. He was able to do it. Extraordinary that I could witness that. You know, just extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, so, yeah. I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead.
Because you mentioned the stroke.
Yeah.
And, you know, I never read Be Here Now. If I did, I forgot. But I did read A Spiritual Journey. It was about meditation. And I saw this documentary after he had a stroke about him. That's Fierce the first Grace. Time I saw Krishna Das, too. He's in that documentary.
Yeah.
And everything you're saying is, I mean, it's right on the money as far as he's concerned, to have suffered this stroke and to have been so at peace with it. You know, if it happened to me, I go, why is this happening to me? You know, how horrible is catastrophe?
He did say that. He said, as he was being, you know, shoveled down the corridor in the gurney, when it and he's looking up at the pipes and going, what, Maharaji, were you out to lunch? What happened, you know? And then it switched into, the guru gave me the stroke in order for me to become who I truly am, blah, blah. He went to India just before he started living in Maui. And he went to India in 2004. and hadn't been there, obviously, in a long time. And it was a tough road to hoe, but he made it. And he met this saint, woman saint, who was close to Neem Karoli Baba, named Siddhima, our Indian mother. And she had heard him say, oh, Neem Karoli Baba gave me the stroke. And he'd say this kind of what ended up being BS-y kind of stuff. Because she said, are you kidding? Nakura's not giving you a stroke. Who? Nature. It's called nature. You had a stroke. And nature meant, you know, he wasn't really taking care of himself. He was overweight. He wasn't taking his blood pressure. You know, all of the stuff that contributes to someone, you know, karma. That's what it was about. What he gave you was the grace of having the perspective to use it to flourish in a way that he hadn't quite flourished before. That's a kind of funny word to use, but it's come up lately, actually. I love it. So, yeah, that was what it was about for him, and he did absolutely become whoever he was talking about, where he was talking from prior to the stroke, he became that thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the beauty of it.
Yeah, it's beautiful the way you put it. The grace, that's a perfect way to describe his personality, his attitude. I mean, when I saw the documentary, he's dancing in his wheelchair, you know, pretty much. He's clapping along with the music. He's just joyful. And it's a real inspiration, something to really look up to.
Absolutely. It was a beautiful model for us all.
Beautiful.
So also another interesting story I just happened upon that you met up with Eazy-E. You got to tell us about that.
Yeah.
Famous rapper who had a label called Ruthless Records, and NWA was there. I mean, it was a famous kind of situation that Jerry Heller, tell us about this. I know a little.
NWA, big rap group with famous rappers, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Dr. Dre. So Dr. Dre left. Yeah, he was the producer. He produced all their hits, all their records. And he left the band. The band broke up, and Eazy-E was doing a solo record, and he needed a producer. And at that time, my partner and I, we were a team called Wolf and Epic. His name is Brett Epic Mazur, and I'm Wolf. And so we were a team producing hip hop, and we were pretty successful. And so Jerry would call, and I didn't want to talk to him. This is something about deep listening. I didn't even want to hear what he had to say. But my partner talked to him. And he would call all the time, say, come on over to, you know, we have an office in Woodland Hills. Eazy wants to meet you. His real name was Eric. You know, Eric wants to meet you, wants to talk to you. And I would say to my partner, why are you talking to him? You know, he's misogynistic. He's homophobic. We don't want anything to do with this. And so we just ignored it. Finally, my partner said to me after like the 10th time that Jerry called, he said, let's just listen to what they have to say. It's very wise. My partner, he was like 17 years younger than me. He was like, I don't know, 15 at the time, something like that.
Really?
Well, he was 17 or 18 at the time. So we went over there. And I'm very skeptical, but there was Jerry. It was a small, you know, Eric's office was very small. He's sitting behind a desk, and there's Jerry. And they were like normal people, regular people. And you could see the father-son dynamic, the love between Jerry and Eazy-E, and the respect, mutual respect. And I think that disarmed us, you know. And they were just, you know, pretty humble, not threatening at all, not boasting at all, and just trying to talk and say, why can't we work together? And we say we'd keep meeting with them, and he used to come to my studio and hang out. You know, he was watching us create music he was into. We're all lovers of hip-hop and funk, and we would listen to funk, or we were producing or remixing something, and he would hang out. he'd come with, Eazy-E would come with two bulging pockets. In one pocket, it was weed. In the other pocket was $100 bills. Anyway, we became friends. And finally, we had a meeting in his office. And I said, look, if you can guarantee us you're not going to have homophobic, misogynistic, or randomly violent lyrics, we'll do, you know, you want us to do half the album, we'll do half the album. And he laughed at me and he said, y'all are crazy. And I said, you know, we're crazy and you're sane, but that's how we feel. And we left on good terms. And then my partner formed a Jewish rap group called Blood of Abraham with spiritual lyrics that Eazy-E loved and signed to his label and executive produced.
No. So, that's so funny. Wow.
So the Eazy that I knew, that I saw, was a sweetheart.
Really?
And in business, he was, okay, he was ruthless in business, but with us, it was not a problem. And just as a person, in terms of being respectful of everybody, that's all I ever saw. Hmm. That gangster image was an image.
Right. Another thing that caught my eye was your little chapter on transcending the self. Mm-hmm. And I've been working a lot on a project that is basically quoting Krishnadas, which is, you wake up in the morning to the movie of me. You're the producer, director, protagonist, you're the whole writer. You're the whole thing 24/7. Isn't that fun? So we're working on something from the movie of me to the movie of we that I'm working on with a friend of mine. So This transcending the self, and that's what, when I read that, that's what I'm thinking. And then you quote Bruce Springsteen, who we all love more than love. And he said, I think you saw in an article that he said performing music for him was a vehicle for self erasure. I love that so much. Right. Oh my God. And then you also quote Eminem, Lose Yourself, one of his songs. And that, I don't know if you can say what else you can say about, but say something, because that is what it is all about, as far as I'm concerned.
That is absolutely correct.
Okay,
that is
what
it's all about. That is my favorite part. That is the most important part of the whole deal, whether you're talking about music and you're talking about meditation. It's in music, you're connecting with something that's beyond, it's transpersonal. That's why people love to sing the national anthem when they go to a ball game, or every religion that I'm aware of, people are singing, you know, kirtan or hymns, whatever. And every religion has people singing together, because you're connecting beyond yourself. And then you're connecting beyond everything through music. The problem is that you get this high, right? As Springsteen says, I rise up and I vanish into the music, right? You mentioned vanish. And it's a high. But the problem is that you got to come down off the stage, and you got to come down off your high. And then you got to live with yourself again.
Not fun for these people. Yeah.
Right? Difficult. And you have to face the challenges of your life now. And so many musicians, they get, you know, they're down at the bottom of the stage, you know, and now what do? I'm lost. I have no more purpose. Yeah. And then when you meditate, you can realize that, wait a second, you're not only an instrument when you're playing music. Your whole life is an instrument of something that's bigger than you. And your purpose is limitless. And when you see that, it really helps you face the fact that you now have to live with yourself, because you find out that the self that you have to live with is not what you think it is.
That's a biggie. That takes lifetimes of practice.
It does.
Yeah. And, you know, what obviously the thing isn't to become, as Jack Kornfield says, a good meditator.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's mm-hmm. to become a loving, kind, compassionate purpose, mm-hmm. a person rather, mm-hmm. with that purpose in mind.
Mm-hmm.
But I do, one other thing that struck me, I do love this quote from John Cage that you put in here. I always like quotes from people like this. I had accepted the idea that the purpose of music is to sober and quiet the mind, thus making one susceptible to divine influences. Mm. True right, true on, you know.
Totally.
Although I must say I have never been able to absorb John's music. For talk about dissonance and weird rhythmic structures and so on. Oh boy. I guess that's why I loved when I was a kid pop music. I mean, I still love a good hook and a chorus. You got me. Right. That was always really important. And that's the beauty of it all. Boy, there's something for absolutely, it's like Hinduism. There's something for everyone in it. There's a billion gods and goddesses and practices.
Well, Cage, as you know, was studied Zen.
Yeah.
He was a student of D.T. Suzuki and very influenced by that.
All of what we've been talking about. We got a lot of links here for sure. Two different wonderful musicians and thought leaders and so on. So we'll have that all in our show notes. So you just got to go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling and you'll get hooked up, including the new single from Richard. Oh, Richard.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. And really happy to meet you, especially through this particular medium. This is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and we shall see you next week.
Bye. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's been fantastic. You.